To start things off today, I want to talk about a something that's going on our campuses across this country that you may not be aware of. It seems to go beyond political correctness and comes really to the point of students on those campuses not only trying not to be offended themselves, but to protect other students from possibly being offended. And it has really ramped up to a tremendous degree that I was unaware of until I read a cover story in the September issue of The Atlantic called The Coddling of the American Mind. One of its co-authors is Greg Lukianoff, who is the CEO of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, and joins me now. Hi, Greg. How are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
Good. Am I right that this goes beyond previous definitions of political correctness?
I definitely think so. I think it's taken on. We actually tried to sort of coin a new term, and we called it vindictive protectiveness instead of political correctness.
Okay. What does that mean?
It basically means that the argument that you should be quiet or you should self-censor or you should, you know, you should absolutely scrub what you say of anything that might be offensive is incumbent on you from me based on sort of my basically saying this other group over there is so vulnerable that in the name of protecting them, I have to do everything in my power to shut you down or shut you up if you say something I don't like.
Okay, now you give a couple of examples in here, and I want to touch on some of the things that you mentioned in your story, but there are two from California that really stand out. That
sure.
At the University of California system, which is universities all throughout the state of California, they are not allowed to say things like, America is the land of opportunity, and I believe the most qualified person should get the job. What is wrong with each of those two sentences, Greg?
Well, the claim is that they're microaggressions, and because they, because of what they say, they imply that people who didn't get the job are less qualified, and they imply that other countries, and they imply that people who aren't successful in the U.S. deserve it. Now, of course, I think that those imply nothing of the sort. I think those are very positive ways to look at your country that everyone knows has qualifications and exceptions. But to treat that as a microaggression, which is literally a tiny form of violence against the oppressed, is downright stifling to higher education.
Now, that's a word I had not heard before, microaggressions. Define that for me, or tell me how they would define it, those who are trying to shut down some of our regular verbiage.
You know, it's kind of a shame because I actually like microaggression theory and the idea of looking at the ways in which we sort of unconsciously slight each other, particularly in racist and sexist ways. So the most sort of like understandable sort of example of like a microaggression is, for example, you know, someone who keeps on emphasizing that their African-American friend is really articulate is kind of implicitly saying that, and that's a surprise. So that's something that people kind of cringe at when they hear that. But the problem with studying something and then going to a level where you're policing it is infinite, particularly when microaggressions, and I want to emphasize this, microaggressions are unconscious for the most part. There are things that you say, you know, accidentally. There are things that you say without really reflecting on it. And the problem with policing things, like they are at Ithaca College, by the way, policing things that are unconscious is how on earth are people going to engage in genuine candor with each other if they're constantly watching what they say? And my overall opinion is what's going to happen is people are just going to avoid talking to each other rather than commit a microaggression.
Now, when you say that colleges are policing this sort of thing, are they going to a zero tolerance policy? Because we hear about those sort of things all the time, and they've been going on for 20 years at every level, but it seems like we're now at a below zero tolerance.
Yeah, I don't think we're quite there yet, but that's one of the reasons why we wrote the article and are sounding the alarm. But zero tolerance, my goodness. I mean, talk about, and a lot of these mechanisms, they're so mindless in their application. They don't believe that people can sort of rationally discuss with each other and even offend each other to a degree, and that can be productive.
Is the idea behind all of this, we have to shield our students, our kids, our teenagers and college students from any kind of word or idea that makes them uncomfortable?
That's a big part of it. And I think everything has mixed motivations. So I think sometimes these are used sincerely in an effort to protect people you think are vulnerable. I think sometimes they're used tactically to try to just figure out the best trump card to win an argument. And one thing that we have that was interesting in the article that we really tried to expound upon is all of this is also based on bad psychology.
What do you mean?
That essentially the idea of a lot of these attempts to shield students from offensive words is predicated on this idea of human beings being incredibly fragile, and that people are permanently in that state, that they're not particularly resilient, and that there's something really good about focusing, for example, on tiny unconscious slights. And our argument is, if you even have a passing familiarity with, you know, positive psychology, or for example, what we use in this, which is cognitive behavioral therapy, we make the point that no, this is actually teaching people to think in a way that goes entirely against every bit of research that shows what kind of thinking actually makes someone happy and produces productive arguments.
There's another phrase that you use in your piece, and that phrase is trigger warnings. I'm not familiar with that. What are trigger warnings?
Trigger warnings, they originated, as best we can tell, in sort of the feminist blogosphere for a very understandable reason. If someone was about to talk about, for example, a graphic depiction of sexual violence on their website about, you know, for survivors, they would say, trigger warning, I'm about to go into graphic detail. Now, these, unfortunately, had a tendency to snowball. So even on the internet, by 2012, there were feminist bloggers who were saying, enough is enough. We now have a list of 25 different things, you know, most of which we can't figure out why they would be triggering, that people are requesting trigger warnings for. So we thought that these, you know, trigger warnings kind of went away, even on the internet, maybe in 2012. But for some reason, in the past year and a half, demands and requests for trigger warnings have been popping up on campuses across the country. And what makes this so difficult is just the idea that it suddenly becomes the professor's responsibility to guess what might be triggering. And again, the psychology of triggering is very clear on the fact that if you suffer trauma, for example, anything could potentially be triggering. It's not necessarily a graphic discussion. It could be a color or a smell.
So this started out as authors saying, hey, look, I'm going to get into an area here that's really graphic, and I just want you to know that beforehand. So, you know, kind of like when a TV newscast says, look, we're going to show you this footage now. It's kind of graphic. You may not want to have your kids watch this, which, of course, I think they're doing to make the kids watch it more. But it started out, if I understand you correctly, as authors trying to be sensitive to people who might be reading or viewing their material. Now, is it to the point where college professors are saying, all right, listen, we're going to talk about this, and it's possibly offensive to somebody in this class? Doesn't that attune people in the audience to then be offended? It's almost a cue to them?
It absolutely does. And Connor Fiesserdorf, I always say his name wrong, at The Atlantic, talked about how he knew this would immediately result in people saying, like, why are you privileging that student's trauma and experiences over mine? And unfortunately, what I've seen is that is a natural human tendency. It's like, well, why is that person getting special treatment? Meanwhile, there was a beautiful comment by someone on The Atlantic article talking about having lost her sister to suicide from jumping off of a building. And she explained that they covered a book that had a scenario like that in class, and nobody gave her a trigger warning, and nobody told her, nobody singled her out to say, you know, you might want to not read this. And she felt normal for the first time in years. And that's the thing, is if you emphasize the idea that sort of like you are traumatized and you are going to be broken forever, that goes against every idea of psychology of trying to actually help people live in the world again, me and my co-author, social psychologist John Haidt, are familiar with.
Now, Greg, speaking of the real world, what happens when these students get out of college and get into the real world? Are they going to be swamping corporate HR departments with complaints that there was no trigger warning in a meeting?
I hate to say it, but from the reports I've been getting, they already are. And people talk about, that we're doing these students a disservice for when they get into the real world, because the real world is hard. And I think there's a lot of truth in that. But I also think that they're going to bring some of these attitudes with them. I think they're going to bring an expectation that they should be shielded from the topics they dislike. Probably the most disturbing example of this, and I do actually think to a degree of law school as being kind of like the real world, is Jeannie Suk, a professor at Harvard Law School, wrote an article about her and her colleagues increasingly being asked not to cover the law of sexual assault in their criminal law class, which, by the way, is, of course, standard to cover in criminal law class.
And important for potential lawyers to know about.
Exactly. Because students found it difficult and offensive. And what is so mind-boggling about this is, who suffers the most from lawyers not knowing the law of sexual assault?
Yeah.
Victims of sexual assault.
Right. How did we get here?
You know, I wrote a short book called Freedom from Speech, where I came up with my sort of larger theory that I thought I thought I explained a million times. But I tend to think that there, as societies get more affluent, as they get different ways to deal with physical discomfort, as they can increasingly live in communities that reflect their values and reflect their political beliefs, and can consume, for example, only media that already agrees with their preconceived notions,
Yeah. We
get less good at dealing with intellectual discomfort. So I think in some ways that problems like this are an inevitable side effect of some otherwise good things. But we have to come up with mechanisms for helping people actually not infinitely cower in the face of reality.
And I think the internet is a big part of it as well, because the internet allows Yep. Everybody to express their thoughts immediately, comment on everything that's going on every website, on every radio and TV show and everything that's going on, and express how they're offended. And then other people read that and go, oh, I don't want to offend people, so I have to Right. Pull myself back. Isn't that part of it?
Oh, absolutely it is. And it also plays into the fact that you can have an internet experience where 99% of the people you talk to are just saying right on, and those times when you just reduce someone's argument to just, oh, you're offensive to me, you think that everyone's going to cheer you.
And this is not to say that you don't sometimes have genuine reason to be offended. There is racism in the world. There is real sexism in the world. There are horrible things that are said about people on a daily basis, and there are these microaggressions that are almost shrouded in compliments sometimes,
Yep. But
they're compliments that are really not compliments.
Absolutely.
And those things do exist, but it goes too far. I'd like to ask you to tell two stories from your article. One is about the word indigenous, and the other one is about the student at Purdue reading a book about Notre Dame and the Klan.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so there was this complex UCLA case involving a professor who was very concerned with social justice, but his students brought a complaint against him for many sins and microaggressions. One of them was including that he marked a student, he corrected a student who used a capital I for the word indigenous when it should actually be a lower I. And that was an ideological microaggression against that student because she chose her punctuation for political reasons.
That's all I can say when I hear a story like that.
And I come from a background doing refugee law, and I'm kind of like, is this really going to be, like, you know, helping people who are facing genocide and torture and are refugees? But anyway.
Yeah. So indigenous is now a proper noun. It's no longer an adjective.
And it's a political statement.
Okay, and the Notre Dame versus the Klan.
Oh, yeah, that's a story I talk about in my book, Unlearning Liberty, which is actually my first long book, and it's just... Okay, so it's a student. He was reading a book called Notre Dame versus the Klan. He was reading it publicly. This is a book, by the way, and he was at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. And this is a book that celebrates the defeat of the Klan when they marched on Notre Dame. It is absolutely a joyously anti-Klan book, but because an employee saw the word Klan on the cover and saw a picture of the Klan rally when the Klan marched on Notre Dame, he was found guilty of racial harassment without even an opportunity to defend himself. Now, if he had had an opportunity to defend himself, he could have pointed out, this book is available in the library here.
I'm laughing because it's so stupid. This is what I would call below zero tolerance. In other words, Yep. We're not even going to ask you what's the story here. We just heard a story about you, and we are proclaiming you guilty with no investigation.
Absolutely. And that also shows how kind of like our hyper-litigiousness plays a role in this, is that you have some ridiculous ideology going on. You have this kind of culture of overreacting. Then you add to it the idea of like, oh, and by the way, we might get sued. We might have a frivolous lawsuit filed against us if someone's offended. And you have the perfect formula for these crazy overreactions.
Now, a little while ago, Greg, you mentioned politics. And so I've got to ask you, our politics in this country are so skewed one way or the other, at least in the popular media. I don't believe that the basic population of the United States cares about most of the issues that get argued about in the media, because everybody's too busy taking their kids to soccer and trying to make enough money to pay their mortgage every month. Those are the priorities for most Americans. But on the popular culture front, we have increasingly partisan politics to blame.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that extends to what you're talking about or is part of the same problem.
I absolutely think they're related, and that's one of the reasons why I was so thrilled to write this with John Haidt, because he wrote a great book called The Righteous Mind that analyzes the culture wars, whereas I analyze it also from the point of view of hyperpolarization due to the fact that we increasingly are isolated from people who disagree with us. And one of the most distressing pieces of research I found in the course of doing my first book was that the amount of education you have and the amount of political disagreements you have are inversely correlated. And what that means is that high school, people would only have, who have a high school degree or less tend to have the most sort of political disagreements, but like actual engagement across lines of political difference. Whereas college students have less, master's students have less, and PhDs have less. And this indicates to me we're doing something terribly wrong. You would, I think what we should be inculcating into people who go to college is they should see it as a duty to seek out smart people with whom they disagree, not just a mere inconvenience.
Yeah, that's a very, very good point. So I'm going to ask you a question here, but I have to have a trigger warning that this might offend animal rights activists. Can this be fixed, or is the horse out of the barn?
That is pretty offensive. I hope it can be fixed. I think it needs to be fixed. I think the reason why free inquiry and free speech stands a real fighting chance is because it works really well. It's just better at coming up with better, more stable, more sturdy ideas. But I do get scared sometimes because partially because the justification behind this sounds so warm and fuzzy. It sounds so nice. It's hard to actually be someone like, you know, me and John actually saying, listen, I know your intentions are mostly good on this stuff, but what you're doing is actually not helping discourse, and it's not even helping the students that you think it's helping.
And I bet you it's also increasing anxiety and perhaps even creating mental health issues because you're teaching a generation of kids to be thought to think of themselves as potentially a victim every moment of their lives.
That's a great segue. That's exactly what the article is about. It's making the point that we're teaching what are called cognitive distortions. We're teaching students basically like it's the equivalent of saying, oh, by the way, no matter what you heard before, totally sweat the small stuff. And of course, you should totally sweat the small stuff if you want to be miserable for the rest of your life.
Yeah. I should point out that the piece in The Atlantic that Greg Lukianoff and Jonathan Haidt wrote is paired with another piece by Caitlin Flanagan about how college students can't seem to take a joke, and that's about the comedians that are trying to get booked for campus gigs around the country and how they can't cross the line, that they have to scrub everything they say in their act of anything that could potentially offend anyone. So this has much more far-reaching effects than just what goes on in the classroom, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And actually, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I'm actually executive producer of a documentary called Can We Take a Joke, in which we interview, you know, top comedians, including Adam Carolla and Gilbert Gottfried and Lisa Lampanelli, to talk about this phenomenon and about how we've trained a generation to be so addicted to outrage that it really harms comedy. And I really think it's important to enlist the comedians on our side for the fight for open expression, because the idea of losing something that's so treasured, like parody, satire, comedy, just in the name of sort of a self-righteous attempt to sort of shut people down is not something any of us should take lying down.
Very well said. Both of these pieces are in the September issue of The Atlantic. We will link to them on the website, and thank you, Greg. Greg Lukianoff is an attorney and president and CEO of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. His books include Unlearning Liberty, Campus Censorship, and the End of American Debate, and Freedom from Speech. Thanks so much for joining me here today, Greg.
Thank you. Take care.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.